This is Company Cars, the podcast that tries to make sense of the car business. Hello, and welcome to another episode of Company Cars. On this episode, we are going to start a multi-episode series, and we'll step back into history dating back to the 1980s and talk about a question that you probably haven't thought about. So if you've been driving around, you've probably seen some cars, like you see Hondas, Toyotas, and Nissans, but you also probably see Acuras, Lexuses, and Infinities. And you may have wondered, or may not have wondered, where did these brands come from? And why were these brands created? And how did the approach differ between each of the three brands? So in this series, we're going to explore the origin story of Japanese luxury cars, and we'll walk through how the business decisions underlying the creation of each of the three brands that we see today have shaped who they are now. And we'll also talk about a mystery fourth brand that never made it to the starting line, but had basically completed almost all of its work before deciding that they wouldn't move forward. So diving right in, where did Japanese luxury cars come from? And so before we can talk about how each of these brands were created, we should talk about the context in which they were created. And let's flash back to the 1980s. Gordon Gekko was in fashion, greed was good. Ronald Reagan was president, and Reaganomics was all the rage. The yuppie was a status symbol, and Americans were buying droves of, quote, funny foreign cars like Hondas, Nissans, and Toyotas from middle-class Americans, and Saabs, Volvos, BMWs, and Mercedes-Benzes for the new yuppie professional class. But more importantly, the 1980s saw the economic rise of Japan. Much like how today we have concerns over the economic rise of China, during the 1980s, many people were worried about Japan's booming economy and how they were eventually going to take over the world. So the 1980s saw Japan begin to really establish itself as a major economic player in terms of manufacturing and research and development, because they had successfully shifted their economy to focus on the production of high-value products such as computers and automobiles. And the automobile market was a prime example. So in the U.S., the Japanese automakers had started to build a strong following for their very affordable, high-quality, fuel-efficient small cars that consumers tended to prefer over similar cars from Chrysler, Ford, and GM. So during the 1980s, the Japanese automakers actually were able to grow their market share to almost a third of the entire U.S. market. So this was pretty impressive, and Japan was flush with cash. Japanese companies were making money hand over fist, and they were looking for new projects to pursue and looking for their next big project. So as the 1980s progressed, U.S. policymakers became increasingly concerned over Japanese automakers' continued growth in the U.S. market and their taking away of market share from the domestic manufacturers Chrysler, Ford, and GM. So instead of saying, hey, Chrysler, Ford, and GM, you should make better cars, one of the policy tools the U.S. employed was the U.S. and Japan mutually agreed upon export quotas for the Japanese automakers that existed throughout the 1980s. So the Japanese automakers agreed to this because they were worried that any negative anti-Japanese backlash in the U.S. could hurt their U.S. sales. And at the same time, the Japanese automakers were starting to build U.S. assembly plants to assemble more of their cars here. So they were fine with the export quotas because they were already starting to build a manufacturing presence in the U.S. But these export quotas meant that anything that came from Japan should probably be the highest value, most profitable products, because each automaker would have a limited number of cars they could send out of the country, and in essence, they should produce their most expensive cars in Japan and produce their less expensive cars at their factories in the United States here. In addition, there was widespread debate over whether or not the government of Japan was manipulating their currency to make Japanese vehicles more attractive to U.S. consumers once factoring in the exchange rate, and there was a continuing conversation about whether or not the Japanese automakers were illegally dumping cars onto the U.S. market in violation of World Trade Organization rules, and a lot of these were rumors that were never fully substantiated, but there was kind of this swirling air of mystery around how the Japanese automakers could produce so much car for so little money at such high quality. Japanese cars at the time were generally priced well below their American competitors. So set in this context, the Japanese automakers responded to trade tensions, tariffs, and quotas in two ways. The first is they established U.S. manufacturing facilities to try to get around the export controls and tariffs. The idea behind this project was that if we can build cars in the country where we sell them, then those cars won't count towards our export quota from Japan, and so we'll be able to sell more cars if we can make some of those cars in the United States. So throughout the 1980s, you saw Nissan, Toyota, and Honda establish U.S. assembly plants. So these included Honda's factory in Marysville, Ohio, Toyota's factory in Georgetown, Kentucky, and Nissan's factory in Smyrna, Tennessee. These were some of the earliest Japanese-owned manufacturing facilities for cars in the United States. And they each produced kind of high-volume, popular cars that people bought. So Honda produced the Accord in Marysville, Toyota produced the Camry in Georgetown, Kentucky, and Nissan produced the Altima and Maxima in Smyrna, Tennessee, eventually. So these are big plants that are designed to serve the U.S. market. And the other thing that the Japanese automakers decided to do was they decided that what they would export from Japan with the limited quotas they had would have to be far more expensive cars than the cars that they were exporting in the early part of the 1980s. So basically what they could do is if they could sell more expensive cars, then they could earn more money from the limited number of quota slots they had for cars to leave Japan and enter the United States. Simultaneously, the Japanese economy was booming, each of the major automakers were flush with cash, and they had ready access to capital with lots of banks willing to lend them money for all of these expansion projects, and their core automaking business was very profitable. So they had a lot of financial muscle to take on this big new project of developing a high-end luxury car. So in the early 1980s, each of the three largest Japanese automakers, Honda, Toyota, and Nissan, decided independently that it made sense to pursue the development and production of larger, more luxurious, and more expensive cars than anything they had ever produced before. So they had each decided that if they could produce a car that could go after a Mercedes-Benz or a BMW, then they could make a lot of money and offer a really compelling product to consumers. Mazda also decided to pursue the development of luxury cars too, but they didn't make this decision until later during the 1980s, and waiting to make this decision is going to have profound consequences for Mazda. But we'll get to that discussion when we talk about Mazda's luxury car attempt later. So interestingly, even though each of Nissan, Toyota, and Honda decided roughly about the same time that they should pursue a luxury car project, they each went about it in very different ways. And the different business decisions that they made along the way are going to really affect, one, how their cars are eventually perceived when they hit the market, and two, it's going to really affect how each of these automakers thinks about their luxury car business as they mature throughout the 1990s and 2000s, and how they make follow-up business decisions that have led each brand of Acura, Lexus, and Infiniti to the positions where they are now. So we're going to start our conversation with Honda, who was actually the first of the three automakers to hit the market in 1986 with a brand called Acura. And they had a two-car lineup. They had the Acura Legend, which was their primary product, and they had the Acura Integra, which was kind of a smaller, less expensive car that they could offer to drive traffic to showrooms. So the Acura Legend was bigger and longer than anything Honda had attempted to produce before. So in modern terms, the original Acura Legend is about the size of maybe a little bit smaller than a modern Honda Accord and a little bit bigger than a modern Honda Civic. So cars have grown a lot since the 1980s, but in the 1980s, this was bigger than anything Honda had ever really produced, and this was going to be their first car with a V6 engine. So Honda felt like they needed a partner to help them break into the luxury car business. And they wound up partnering with a company called the Rover Group from Britain. So this is the company that also produced the classic Mini, Land Rover SUVs. They had a brand called Rover itself. And so Honda really relied upon Rover and Rover Group for experience about building a luxury car and what things should they put into a luxury car. Unfortunately, Rover Group had a really bad reputation for quality in Britain, and they had kind of suffered through a lot of quality issues. And so Rover Group chose to partner with Honda because they wanted to learn things about how to build high-quality, reliable cars from Honda. So it was a pretty symbiotic relationship during the 1980s. And the idea was you kind of had these two relatively smaller automakers compared to some of the big ones who could share the development costs of this really expensive project, a luxury car. And they would each get a version of the car to sell themselves in different markets. And so Honda and the Acura brand project was primarily for North America. And so Rover Group actually did not really sell sedans in North America at the time. And so they sold the Acura Legend as a Rover Group product in the UK and Europe. And so it was a nice thing because neither brand would really overlap with each other. And even though Rover Group did sell a few units of the Acura Legend as a Rover Group product in the US, it didn't last very long and it was a very short experiment for them. So the relationship worked out well in the sense that they both had skills and expertise in something that the other partner lacked. And the Legend ended up being a mid-size luxury sedan. So Honda kind of aimed for the heart of the market. So if you think of the luxury sedan market at the time, you had kind of large luxury cars like a Mercedes S-Class or BMW 7 Series or Cadillac DeVille. You had mid-size luxury cars, so like a Mercedes-Benz 300E, a BMW 5 Series, a Lincoln Continental, kind of this middle market. And then you had kind of the compact luxury kind of sports sedan segment that was like a BMW 3 Series, Saab 900, or Volvo 240. And so Honda decided to aim right towards the middle of the market. And so the Legend was a mid-size sedan, and it was designed to compete head-on with the Mercedes-Benz 300E, which we now refer to as the E-Class, the BMW 5 Series, and the Saab 9000, among other competing cars. And so, setting the template for Nissan and Toyota later, Honda decided that if they were going to do a luxury car project, they couldn't sell this luxury car in existing Honda showrooms, because somebody who was otherwise considering a Mercedes-Benz, they figured, is probably not going to want to go to a dealership that has tons of Civic and Accord customers just lined up outside. They needed a more exclusive, quieter space where they could get more personalized attention. So Acura was set up as a completely separate division from Honda and had its own separate dealer network, separate showroom facilities, and separate retail sales staff. So customers would only be interacting with Acura dedicated salespeople. And the idea here was they wanted to make the experience very similar to shopping at a BMW or Mercedes-Benz dealership, because you were going to spend BMW and Mercedes-Benz kind of money, and so you should have a whole ownership experience that reflected that. And now it's time for a short break. We'll hear from our sponsors and we'll share some information about how to submit a listener question. The Company Cars podcast is sponsored by Rejected Conjectures Incorporated, a division of Integrated Derivatives. If you have a question that you want answered on the show, write us an email at companycarspodcast@gmail.com. So Acura was developing the Legend and setting up the concept of Acura as a separate dealer network and a separate brand, so completely separated from Honda to the consumer. But one challenge with this strategy is when you're presenting the business case to potential car dealers, it's very difficult for car dealerships and car dealer owners to justify building a whole new facility to sell one car, which is exactly what Honda was asking of them. So Honda scrambled to provide the Acura brand with a second car. So the idea was if we had two cars, it'll be easier for dealerships to justify building a whole new showroom, hiring a whole new dedicated staff, and building a whole new separate service facility. So if we can give them two products to sell and the promise of more to come later, then that will help us with signing up dealers. So Honda looked around and Rover Group wasn't really working on anything they could take, and they looked in its Japanese product portfolio and they found this product called the Integra, which was this higher end version of the Civic. And they said, this is perfect. We're going to take this. So we're going to take the Honda Integra from the Japanese market, and we're going to sell it in the US as the Acura Integra. And it's this sporty two-door hatchback, four-door hatchback, or four-door sedan that's really close in size to a compact car. So it's close in size to a Saab 900. And it was actually smaller than a BMW 3 Series or Mercedes 190E at the time, so it actually slotted in below those two cars. And the Integra was closely related to the Honda Civic of the time, but it was bigger than the Civic, it was more luxurious than the Civic, it was more fun to drive than the Civic, and it had higher performance engines than the Civic. So it was in this intermediate space between a Honda Civic and a BMW 3 Series. And Honda saw that there was really no other product in this space, and they figured if they could create a really low-priced entrance to the Acura brand, they could build owner loyalty. And so over time, the idea was these Integra buyers would come back eventually for a Legend. So Acura went to the market with two models in 1986. Because the Integra was already deep into development for Japan and almost ready to go, it required very little incremental work to bring to the U.S. market. So they were ready to launch in 1986. They were the first Japanese luxury brand to come to the U.S., and they had two products. They had the Integra and the Legend. And so according to Honda, who has kept actually pretty good records of the history of Acura, they launched the brand with 60 dealerships nationwide. So not a very large dealer network, but of course they focused these dealers in major metropolitan areas that had enough customers who were buying BMWs and Mercedes and other European luxury cars that they figured they could pick off a few of these customers to at least give Honda a try. And at the time, nobody really took Honda seriously. So allegedly at the time, the president of Volvo Cars North America said, "We don't think that the Japanese will ever be able to penetrate the U.S. luxury market." Full stop. So Volvo felt like Acura was no big deal, they weren't going to really go anywhere, and it wasn't going to make a difference in Volvo's business. And Honda likes to point out that they proved Volvo wrong, and so the late 1980s were fantastic for Acura. They were the only Japanese luxury brand on the market, so they had the whole market of consumers who wanted a reliable, reliable, durable, high-quality luxury car for not a lot of money. They had a complete monopoly on that market. And so they captured a lot of it. And so they took advantage of their reputation for quality and value from the Honda brand and applied it to the luxury space. And consumers bought a large number of Legends and Integras. And the brand was really tightly focused. And so Honda did a lot of things right with the PR and marketing rollout of the brand in 1986. And they basically said, "We are here to provide high quality, high value, high performance luxury cars." And they summed all this up with their tagline, which they still use today, actually, "Precision Crafted Performance." And it's a pretty good tagline because it sums up kind of everything that they're trying to do with the brand. And within a year or two, according to Honda, so by 1987, Acura was selling 110,000 cars a year in the US, which was more cars than every other European luxury car maker in the U.S. And so Acura started out with a bang, and they were off to a great start. So Honda likes to say that it was because Acura was such a success that Toyota and Nissan followed, but the reality is Toyota and Nissan were already deep into their own efforts to enter the luxury car market using slightly different approaches each. And so Honda likes to take credit for that, but the reality is they'd been thinking about it long before that. So in short, Honda was able to enter the U.S. luxury car market the fastest of the three automakers because they partnered with an existing luxury car maker, Rover Group, to kind of share development costs and development time for the Legend, and they borrowed a car that already existed in their Japanese product portfolio, the Integra. So putting together their product lineup didn't require a lot of work, especially for the Legend, because they shared a lot of these costs with another company. And this is going to be very different from how Toyota pursues its development of the original Lexus. And we'll come back to that in a later episode. But Honda was first out of the gate, and they took advantage of that. So they had a very tightly crafted message, and they had two cars that really complemented each other. And in addition, they aimed these two cars not at the very top of the market, but they aimed them in the highest volume segments. And so they aimed them kind of at the lower end where they could draw a lot of buyers from maybe even a mainstream car who want to step up. So think of somebody who just graduated from college and is ready to buy their first new car. And maybe is a working professional in a major city and wants to buy something just a little bit nicer than the Honda Civic they'd been driving in college. And the Legend was positioned in a way that attracted a lot of customers who would have otherwise considered a Saab or a Volvo, a BMW, who could get the same car for thousands less. And it was right in the heart of the market, and you also had Honda reliability and Honda quality. And so the cars were very popular very early on. However, this strategy of aiming for kind of the core of the market and where the sales are, and aiming for to draw people out of a mainstream car and into their first luxury car, the strategy, in my opinion, I think is going to come back to haunt them, and I think still haunts them to this day. And we'll dig into this a little bit in just a second. So as the 1990s emerged and rolled on, Honda continued with its successful playbook for Acura. And so they continued to update the Legend and Integra. And in 1992, they were getting a lot of feedback that they should have a car in between the Integra and the Legend. And so they introduced this car called the Acura Vigor, which was a luxury sports sedan aimed directly at the Mercedes C-Class, BMW 3 Series, and Lexus ES300. So the Vigor was based on a modified Honda Accord platform, so it was kind of a step above the Integra in terms of refinement and size and price, because the Integra was related to the Civic. And the Vigor was designed to emphasize performance and handling, kind of keeping in line with this idea that Acura was a very performance-oriented brand. But the Vigor suffered from some packaging issues, so it was a really long car and very sleek, but it was very cramped inside. And so it was a bit of a sales failure, and the Vigor only lasted 3 years, from 1992 to 1995, and Honda went right away to work on a replacement that would eventually be called the TL. So when people went to shop the Vigor with the C-Class, the 3 Series, the Lexus ES, and the Saab 900, and others, I think what happened is a lot of buyers wound up getting the Lexus ES300 instead, which was much more practical, quite a bit roomier, and still fairly fun to drive as a car. I think a lot of people forget those early Lexus ES300s were quite fun. But this playbook of taking existing Honda products and upgrading them worked pretty well for Acura during the 80s and 90s, but it became less effective as the 1990s rolled on. So consumer preferences started to evolve, and the European automakers were able to address a lot of their quality and reliability issues that had been a huge draw to Honda and Toyota's luxury brands during the 80s and 90s. So their preferences and expectations moved further and further upmarket, and consumers began demanding more out of their luxury cars, and they wanted a more luxurious experience. And Honda couldn't keep up because they hadn't really had a lot of luxury experience to date, and they had relied pretty heavily on Rover Group, their partner for the Legend, to help them with the luxury side of things. But by the mid-1990s, Rover Group was really struggling, and the company had been split up and sold to different automakers. So first, BMW purchased Rover Group, and then BMW went to work dismantling the company, splitting it into several brands, and then selling them off. So they sold some of the pieces to Ford and some of the pieces to Shanghai Automotive, and they kept some of the pieces for themselves. So Honda was left on its own for designing its luxury cars after the original Legend, and it kind of started to show. So they updated the Legend and renamed it the Acura RL, but it just didn't have that luxury feel relative to its competitors that the original Legend had. It was also much bigger, much floatier, and wasn't very fun to drive. And so Honda also introduced a new midsize luxury car called the TL. They updated the Integra again, and even started selling a luxury SUV borrowed from another Japanese automaker, Isuzu. But none of these cars were really compelling to consumers in the late 1990s, except for the Integra, which had this unique niche of being between where luxury cars typically began and where compact cars from Honda and Toyota, kind of more mainstream brands, ended. So by the late 1990s, Acura was pretty dependent upon the Integra for its reputation and its performance chops. So by pursuing a product strategy of primarily selling Hondas that have been updated and enhanced, I think Acura over the 90s and 2000s started to develop a reputation of selling this kind of mid-tier product, kind of this product between a mainstream car like a Honda and a true luxury car like a BMW. And so I think this idea where Honda could spend not a ton of money and still have a luxury brand presence is what helped them get to the market early in the 1980s, but then they weren't able to evolve with the times and evolve with the increasing demands of the luxury car buyer. Acura did experience a renaissance during the 2000s, so they launched a suite of new products, and they focused primarily on value. And so they came back to their roots a little bit by saying, we are going to have high-quality, high-value luxury cars. And this strategy of offering Honda Plus products, so to speak, it kind of started to run its course by the late 2000s. So one, the underlying Honda products started getting much better. And so the gap between a Honda and its comparable Acura product started to shrink over time. And within Honda, there were lots of reports of internal conflict over how to evolve the brand and how much to spend on evolving the brand, because up to this point, Honda had not had to spend a lot of money to get Acura products out and into the world. So by late 2006, Honda had decided that they were really going to commit and shift substantially upmarket, but then the financial crisis hit and they had to reverse course, and the Honda Plus faction within Honda won out, and they kept focusing on taking an existing Honda product and making it a little bit better around each of the edges, which certainly has a wonderful market for people who are interested in that, but kind of makes it not quite the true luxury car that a lot of luxury car shoppers who are cross-shopping Acuras with Audis and BMWs and Mercedes-Benzes are looking for. So it kind of caused the company to really muddle through the 2010s. And they tried a few things to try and separate the cars from Hondas a little bit. And so they tried some very polarizing styling elements. And some of those efforts didn't really work. And kind of really it all comes back to the core idea that Acura was created fairly quickly and with relatively little investment from Honda. And I think this perception that they could build a luxury car for not very much money, I think still kind of hurts them a little bit to this day. But more recently, though, it seems like Acura is trying to reset itself. So they're once again starting to redesign most of their product portfolio, and these newer products are quite a bit more differentiated from their Honda-related products, and they oftentimes now have dedicated Acura suspensions, dedicated Acura engines, dedicated interiors with very little part sharing between Acura and Honda products, at least based on what's visible to the consumer. So they are trying to move away from this Honda Plus idea, and they've even brought back their original tagline of precision crafted performance to focus the Acura brand more on kind of this sporty driving dynamic and high performance product feel in them. So their new products, their most recent group of products they launched, they have a really consistent look and feel, which is really important for building a clear brand and a clear brand identity. And so they still have a long way to go. They're starting to move in the right direction, I think, to really set up the brand to have a true identity and to not just be known as a slightly nicer Honda that you can buy for thousands less than the comparable BMW. But unfortunately, they may also be a day late and a dollar short with this strategy too, because the entire automotive market is starting to shift dramatically towards electric cars. So it'll be interesting to see if Acura sticks to this kind of like performance focused feel of its products that's really focused around having dedicated engines, dedicated suspensions, and things that are just maybe less important when you have an electric car. So it'll be interesting to see how Acura pivots to EVs. It's important to note here that Honda is partnering with GM for the development of a couple of EVs for the Acura brand. So it'll be interesting to see how those play out. The other part that Honda kind of missed out on with Acura is they didn't really pursue a lot of international expansion. So Honda tried to launch the Acura brand in a couple of East Asian markets throughout the 90s and 2000s, and it didn't really work. And so now Acura is primarily focused on selling cars in the U.S. and Canada. And if you think about what a luxury brand like Mercedes-Benz or BMW does. They sell cars globally, and those two brands have a really strong brand identity anywhere in the world. So that's another kind of area of weakness for Acura, but that may be less important if they're primarily focused on selling cars in the U.S. as a brand, but it's just another thing to point out. And I think in the end, we'll see how Acura evolves and makes the transition to electric cars, but their current strategy, their newest strategy, it might be a little too little too late to really move the brand further up market. So there's a lot of other brands today that are trying to move further up market because profit margins have been totally destroyed at kind of the lower end of the market in the mainstream class. And so one strategy to improve your profitability, especially if you are a smaller brand like Acura, is to try to sell cars for more money. So Volvo and Mazda primarily are also trying to move up market. And I think it's an open question if the luxury car market can support so many different brands. So that's the story of how Acura came to be. On our next episode, we'll talk about Lexus and how Lexus's development story differs from Acura and how that has probably resulted in Lexus being a much stronger luxury brand than Acura and Infiniti. So stay tuned for more and hope you enjoyed it. Of course, it takes a whole village to make a podcast, and so we want to make sure we give due credit to the individuals involved with making this podcast. Our chief technical advisor is Turn It Off and On, and our legal and strategy consultant is Bill Me Moore. Finally, we're assisted by our product planner, Ada Trim, and our finance and insurance manager, Mark Up the Rates. Thank you for listening to our show, and make sure to subscribe to us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.